This is Climate One, changing the conversation about energy, economy, and the environment. For writers and reporters who cover the climate beat, getting to the story can be a challenge.
On some level, it's the worst story ever. It is ubiquitous, but very hard to pin down. It's being caused by everyone and everything. And therefore, it's sort of everything and nothing. And so finding the narrative is very, very difficult.
So what can journalists do to get the story out there?
My goal was always to speak to the political junkies and the nerds and the news obsessives and the bloggers and Twitterers and all those. Speak to those people about this in a way that reaches them and that they understand.
Covering Catastrophe, up next on Climate One. What's it like to write about climate change in a post-truth world? Welcome to Climate One, changing the conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. I'm Devin Strolovich. Climate One conversations with oil companies and environmentalists, Republicans and Democrats, are recorded before a live audience and hosted by Greg Dalton. On today's show, we'll hear two veteran climate reporters talk about their personal stories, media coverage of climate, and how people respond to the massive evidence that climate is changing in their lifetime and in their hometowns. Elizabeth Colbert's 2006 book, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, was instrumental in creating and shaping Climate One. Her 2014 book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, won a Pulitzer Prize, and she continues to cover climate and other stories for The New Yorker. David Roberts earned a wide following covering climate for Grist. He eventually got so burned out that he walked away from the climate beat for a time. But he's back now writing some of the most incisive climate articles anywhere for Vox. Here's our conversation about covering catastrophe.
Elizabeth, let's begin. After the 2000 election, George W. Bush pulled the U.S. out of the Kyoto Climate Accord. You went to Greenland for the first time to learn how that might impact. And then you went to David Remnick, then the new editor of The New Yorker, to pitch him on the stories. Pick it up there.
Well, After George Bush was elected, if people can think back to that moment, it was still a moment where a lot of stories you read about climate were sort of he said, she said kind of stories, and it seemed like I was really a naive at that point, and it seemed like there ought to be an answer to this question: who's saying, you know, what's true, and I should really go find it out. And so that's how this whole journey to the Arctic and beyond began.
And then those stories became Field Notes from a Catastrophe, and you were at that point kind of laying out. Still early, fairly early days. It was before an Inconvenient Truth, before a lot of people had awakened to climate, and you were looking at what signs in the natural world that hey, this is happening.
Yeah, and this is like 2000, and by the time I really did a lot of the reporting for that book, for the series that ran The New Yorker, it was 2004, and that was right at the moment. In fact, the American Geophysical Union had just come out and said. I can't remember the exact quote, but there's unequivocal evidence of climate change right now, the signal emerging from the noise. So it was just at that moment where the scientific community, there were a lot of, you know, people, this crazy idea that the scientific community, you know, is just all jumped on this bandwagon. Absolutely not. People were really, really, a lot of scientists were very hesitant to say, you know, show me the evidence. But right around that moment, in 2003, 2004, a lot of these data sets began to show very clear signs of climate change. And so a lot of the scientific organizations came out with pretty important statements at that point. We all know now in retrospect how much good that did.
And what did you see actually up there in Greenland that was sort of like, what made you gasp?
Well, one of the things I did on in that particular moment is I went to a station, and that was had been set up as a weather station on the top of the ice sheet, which so you're standing on 10,000 feet of ice, basically. And they talked about how the ice had changed and how they had to be there earlier and earlier in the season now, because actually it was melting out so badly it was getting really dangerous. And in fact, when I was there, you know, you could see these rivers forming on the top of the ice sheet, and it was getting pretty dangerous. So so it was a very vivid example of a very, very dramatic change.
David Roberts, around that time, 2003, you were not in Greenland. You were unemployed and adrift in your life. So pick up your story there.
That's a much less romantic story than Elizabeth. Yeah, I had a philosophy master's and a half of a philosophy PhD, and I had bailed out of school and academia and didn't know what the heck I was doing with my life. And saw a Craigslist ad for an editorial assistant at a small web publication called Grist, which at the time had four, I think, full-time employees. And so I wrote a cover letter and said, hey, I have no experience in journalism, no particular interest or experience in environmentalism. However, I really want this job. And wrote a grammatically correct cover letter, which apparently is a rarity, and got hired at Grist. Started in 2004, and was mostly doing editorial stuff and writing news blurbs back when that was a thing. And so just sort of wormed my way very slowly but surely from the editorial side over into writing. Eventually full time. It was sort of, I say journalistically, I was raised by wolves. I was basically just on my own. So everything I learned about this subject matter and everything I learned about journalism, I learned on the fly, on my own during those years. And here's one funny anecdote. It was around 2004, 2005, I started writing full time. 2006, I decided, well, okay, I'm gonna be a writer. I'm gonna be a journalist. Which means, like, journalists interview people, right? So the very first professional interview I ever did in my journalistic career was Elizabeth Colbert.
Ah.
In the wake of her book back in 2006, 11 years ago now.
And did you know he was an untrained hack?
I'm sure she knew by the end of it.
I was going to say, I think that David doesn't realize all journalists learn on the fly. Yeah, I hate to disappoint him.
Elizabeth, you say that one of the challenges of the climate story is the absence of many colorful characters. Why is that?
Well, I mean, climate change is, on some level, it's the worst story ever. it is ubiquitous, but very hard to pin down. It's being caused by everyone and everything. And therefore, it's sort of everything and nothing. And so finding the narrative is very, very difficult. And unfortunately, I would say, and this is journalistically good and for civilization very bad, it's becoming easier and easier. You know, it's becoming easier and easier to go places and have people say, this is climate change, we're looking at it. We're experiencing it. So from a journalistic perspective, actually, just in the, you know, 12, 13 years that I've been doing this, that part of it has really changed.
But there are oil companies. There aren't any good villains, or is it, you know, there's a lack of a villain with an intent to inflict harm. Even people who are burning fossil fuels think they're providing jobs. Is it that the people who are doing solutions are kind of boring and process and not very sexy if you're doing something?
Well, I mean, it's all of the above, and certainly there are villainous people, and, you know, I can name names if you want.
just one or two.
James Inhofe, you know, I mean, they're well-known, you know, sort of, you know, deniers, and there was, you know, the long ExxonMobil campaign, and there's the Heartland Institute, but they're just people sort of putting out falsehoods or propaganda or whatever. They're not even... some of them are pretty smooth characters too, but, you know, fundamentally, I think that the problem is, even as bad as some people are and as misleading as some people are, and, you know, the problem is, you know, we all put gas in our cars. So even if ExxonMobil is, you know, fostering a lot of misinformation, which they certainly have, you know, there's a lot of soul searching that we all have to do. And so, it's not enough even to say that there's a villain. And, you know, it's just definitely one of these situations where we've met the enemy and he is us.
We're all complicit, and that's hard to deal with. Mark Hertzgard is a journalist who believes that many of his colleagues are too concerned about reaction. He wrote an article for The Nation. Let's listen.
I think that too many journalists, especially journalists inside of Washington, D.C., worry way too much about what kind of pushback they're going to get from either their viewers or listeners or readers and the politicians. We have to follow the facts. Look at the coverage of Hurricane Harvey and Hurricane Irma, especially on television, on the networks. ABC and NBC went an entire week of coverage without once mentioning climate change, without once pointing out that these storms are getting stronger because of climate change. That's what the science says. That is irresponsible journalism, because we have been warned about exactly these kinds of extreme weather events. My last piece for The Nation, where I said that this is murder, it amounts to premeditated murder, and we as a society need to punish it as such, or we encourage more of it. Those are strong words. I would not have used those words in 1992 or even 2002. But now, after watching disaster after disaster after disaster, and above all, seeing how the climate deniers in Washington and in the big corporate enterprises of this country are continuing to block action, I think that the phrase premeditated murder is entirely accurate.
Journalist Mark Hertzgard. David Roberts, your reaction.
I get it. There's a cycle people go through when they struggle with climate change, where they sort of, the immensity of it dawns on you in kind of stages. And at each new stage, you're like, damn. And you just want to, like, you know, escalate. And there's journalists now who get caught in the cycle who just, like, it's even worse than that. It's even worse than just, like, looking for these new metaphors, escalating and escalating. But for me, like, I escalate, and then I get as high as I can, and then I got to get up the next day and write more. You know what I mean? So at a certain point, you have to find an equilibrium. You have to find a way to operate on a day-to-day level. You can't just, like, be in this continually escalating sense of, you know what I mean? And so I don't know if I'm articulating that well, but like, I've done that. I've gone through the cycle of escalating rhetoric, and then, like, nowhere to go from there. Then you got to get up the next day and write more, you know? So, and also my sense approaching this subject is that there's sort of cultural and political news, and then there's environmental news in this weird satellite, more or less ignored by the planet. But the two are not very connected. And so my goal was always to speak to the political junkies and the nerds and the news, you know, the news obsessives and the bloggers and Twitterers and all those, speak to those people about this in a way that reaches them and that they understand. And if you just are pounding the table about how this is a crisis and we're all going to die, even if it's true, you get slotted into a mental bucket of the people pounding the table. And like, once you've heard someone pound the table once, you don't really need to go back and hear him pound the table again, you know, like, the table's pounded, like, we get it, you know? So I want to be read on a day-to-day level. So the point is, I'm trying to bridge those two worlds in terms of language, in terms of concerns, in terms of people. That's always been what I've been trying to do. And you can't do that if you just follow this escalation.
Morning paper is on its way. It's all bad news on every page.
You're listening to a Climate One conversation about covering catastrophe and the climate beat. You can subscribe to our podcast at our website, climateone.org. Greg Dalton will continue his conversation in just a moment. We continue now with Climate One. Greg Dalton is talking about covering catastrophe with veteran climate reporters Elizabeth Colbert, who writes for The New Yorker, and David Roberts, staff writer at Vox. Here's your host, Greg Dalton.
Elizabeth Colbert, when you write a piece, first of all, you have to sell it to your editors, but are you thinking about informing people, telling a good story? Do you want to inspire action? Do you think about the impact of your stories and what people will do with the information you give them?
You know, of course you think about it, but I do want to be honest and say that's not my job in a way. And if journalists went around always thinking about what impact, you know, I come out of a newspaper background. I worked at the New York Times for a long time. And, you know, our job was really tell it like it is. That was our job. And I still really hew to that. I'm sort of an old-fashioned journalist in that. And I think that telling it like it is and sort of people can do with this information what they will, that's still the role of journalism, even as journalism becomes more and more partisan and more, you know, tribal. I guess I still believe in something called that we used to call the truth, you know, and I try to follow that. And I can't really know how it's going to impact people. Think of, you know, you would hope you'd have, you know, a million readers. I have no idea how many people are going to react. So I try. If you are always thinking about that, you're not going to take the first step.
So you're not trying to solve the problem.
I don't, that's way above my pay grade, solving this problem. Yeah, I am trying to give people information that I hope, you know, I do hope on some level will inspire people, you know, to think about it at the very least. And I hope a certain number of them will be inspired to do something. But I can't take responsibility for that because, as I say, it's just above my pay grade.
Bill McKibben used to write for The New Yorker. He crossed the line from journalist to activist. Jim Hansen is a scientist who crossed the line into activism. Some people think that hurts his scientific credibility. Bill McKibben, who's been on this program several times, says, look, more information is not solving it. We need to organize. We need to, you know, one more article, one more book, one more podcast or radio show is not going to get it done. Elizabeth, what do you think about that step across that line?
You know, I really, really admire what Bill has done, and it's really an amazing accomplishment, this sort of movement that he has, you know, really personally, I don't want to say he's personally, you know, responsible for the whole movement, but he's really, really played a key role in it. And I think that's super impressive because, you know, journalists are not movement builders as a rule. So it's a really, to be both a successful journalist and a movement builder is an extraordinarily impressive achievement. But I think about it, I don't think that I'm very talented in that way. But I often think, like, would that be a better use of my time? Because as you say, another article, is that really going to move the needle on this? You know, it's discouraging on all fronts. I'm sure, I suspect Bill is discouraged right now. I don't know. I haven't asked him lately.
David Roberts, your thoughts on the idea that more information will lead to more action. Another scientific report, another podcast, another movie. Will more information lead to more action?
I don't think about and more information about climate change necessarily will. I guess to me, the dichotomy between sort of straightforward objective journalist and activist leaves a lot of room in between for various and sundry roles. And I don't know that I would put myself on either end of those. But the way I sort of view it is, at this point, information about climate change has been dispersed. Lots of people out there have absorbed it and are ready to do something. And to me, what's lacking is understandable stories about how we deal with it. Like, what are the solutions, and what are, you know, what are the sort of political and social and economic problems we have to solve to get there? So I view myself as sort of arming people. Like Elizabeth, I would be a terrible activist, just awful. So I view my role as sort of like arming people who do go out and do stuff with good information. And in that sense, I think more information does help. I think people want to know, like, EVs, is that the transportation solution, or is it some mix, or like, what if I want to change transportation, what do I do? So I can give people information about the trends and the facts of that and help guide them. So it's somewhere between those poles, I guess.
And how about the human brain, though? There's a lot of interesting things. Part of my journey in Climate One has been starting with science and these abstract systems. And the system that I think is perhaps most challenging is the one between our two ears, our cognition. And David Roberts, climate is uniquely, and Elizabeth Colbert touched on this earlier, climate is everywhere, yet it's nowhere. And we are uniquely wired not to respond to this threat. If there's a person with a gun or a tiger, we are wired to respond to that immediate threat, and we are not wired to respond to climate change.
Yeah, it might as well have been designed to evade our to evade our notice and evade our filters, and that's true, and it's been hashed over to death at this point. I sort of think that
hashed over to death for some people, but for a lot of people listening, it may not be so old hat.
That's true. Well, I mean, the place to start is just we've evolved with certain emotional and cognitive machinery that was designed for proximate, right? It was designed for your village. It was designed for your immediate physical surroundings. And everything we know or think about in terms of more distant, bigger problems, we do by metaphor, basically, with, you know, who's up, who's down. This is all George Lakoff. If you've read your George Lakoff, it's all metaphorical based on similarities to our physical experience. The problem with climate is that you've gone so far away from physical experience that we lack metaphors. We lack ways. So all our metaphors are kind of capturing bits and pieces of it, but there's almost, we just don't have the language or the conceptual apparatus to wrap our heads completely around it. And I've sort of come to the conclusion that aside from professionals, we don't really need to. Like, if 90% of the American public can say climate change is a problem, politicians should do something about it. To me, that's like they know enough about climate change. The politicians are the ones who are supposed to know, like, you know.
Elizabeth Colbert, you've written about facts don't change people's minds. We're not rational beings. If we were rational beings, you know, there's these red lights flashing in this building, people would run out. There's red lights flashing on our planet, and we're not responding. We're going along business as usual.
Well, we see, I mean, you know, the social science of the last, you know, couple decades has proved this, you know, just time and time again. And you know, sort of gets back to what David's saying. I think that, you know, we're just, you know, evolved creatures, and we evolved to solve a certain set of problems. And the fact that we've now created for ourselves an entirely different set of problems, I think is just, you know, one of these many examples of sort of evolutionary, you know, mismatch that scientists talk about. But one thing I'd like to add to what David was saying before is not only is climate change, you know, not like some, you know, tiger coming to your village, or, you know, even villages are actually late, very late in our evolutionary history. But it actually is, I think, other metaphors that we search for or look for, which are other forms of pollution problems that we've, you know, solved, let's say, it even is different from that in the sense that climate change is a cumulative problem. So when we went to solve, you know, acid rain, and we tried to get sulfur dioxide out of smokestacks, then the acid rain problem actually relatively quickly was, I don't want to say solved, but it was mitigated. Whereas with climate change, the problem is it's a cumulative, for all intents and purposes, it's a cumulative problem. And once you decide to solve it, the sense that, okay, that it's too late now, I think people don't have a really hard time getting their heads around that. They think when it's bad, when I look out the window and things are bad, then we'll solve it and we'll deal with it. But it doesn't work that way. And so we're up against not just, you know, the mismatch with the tiger, but the mismatch even with other problems that we have as a society faced, environmental problems.
Yeah, let me just add, I'll put the same point more provocatively. I think the fact that climate change entered social consciousness in the guise of an environmental problem has done more to distort the way people think about it and the way we've tried to react to it than anything else.
And you are quite clear that you were not environmentalist, as we heard when you got your first job, and you're not part of the environmental tribe, and you're not part of that orthodoxy.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly not trying to cast aspersions on environmentalists. God bless them. I didn't come up through that. Right, so I think there's sort of a pipeline now where people come up through college, they canvass for the Sierra Club, they learn certain you know, there's certain ways of thinking that come along with that, and I just sort of came from outside that for good and bad and didn't think those ways. But I think, like what Elizabeth said about it being cumulative, about it being so slow, and furthermore, it's not just physically different than those problems, but politically, once you put something as an environmental problem, there's this whole set of stereotypes that
descend
on
it automatically.
Yeah, like everybody knows how to deal with environmentalists. They're in paragraph three. Environmentalists said no, and then, you know, like everybody just that's baked in, right? Politically, it's also, I think, a poisonous way of thinking about it.
Not long ago, Hank Paulson, who was Treasury Secretary during the financial crisis, was sitting here on this stage and said, as bad as that was, humans could sit around in a room and they had the tools, you may like them or not, they had the tools to solve that problem when it got really bad, basically print money. And when the climate crisis gets bad, any group of wise men and women sitting in a room do not have the ability or the tools to solve the meltdown the way they did with that financial crisis. We're talking with New Yorker writer Elizabeth Colbert and Vox reporter David Roberts at Climate One. I'm Greg Dalton. We're going to go to our lightning round. The first part, I'm going to mention a word or phrase and ask them for their first thought, unfiltered, without thinking about what anyone would think or react. So, David Roberts, Energy Secretary Rick Perry.
Dunce.
Elizabeth Colbert, Scott Pruitt.
Ooh.
I already used dunce.
Yeah. Nefarious.
David Roberts, comedian Andy Borowitz.
Oh, God. No comment? Are we allowed to have no comment on these?
Elizabeth.
Not my cup of tea.
Elizabeth Colbert, 2 degrees of warmer global average temperatures.
Bad.
David Roberts, Texas climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe.
Hero.
Elizabeth Colbert, Ann Coulter.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I'll leave it at that. Yeah.
She did tweet recently, quote, "I don't believe Hurricane Harvey is God's punishment for Houston electing a lesbian mayor, but that is more credible than climate change."
I'll let that speak for itself.
That was her tweet. Now, true or false, I'll ask Elizabeth Colbert and David Roberts to respond to a statement with true or false. That's a one-word answer, even if that reduction causes you agonizing pain. True or false, Elizabeth Colbert, rats have followed humans to nearly every corner of the globe.
Undeniably true.
Also, Elizabeth Colbert, and you interviewed an expert for The Sixth Extinction who thinks one day rats will take over the Earth.
True.
David Roberts, you think they have already taken over this country.
True. Metaphorically true.
David Roberts, people should stop trying to persuade others to adopt their views. It rarely works.
Agony. False.
David Roberts, true or false, no one cares what the Pope thinks.
False. Why are you trying to do this to me, man?
We talked on the phone last week and had a different answer.
Private conversation.
Elizabeth Colbert, fashion reporters do stupid and trivial work.
Wow. True and false.
Elizabeth Colbert, many liberals opposed to GMOs do not understand the basic underlying science.
Probably true.
David Roberts, that's similar to conservatives who don't understand the science underlying climate change.
I think that's false.
Elizabeth Colbert, many opponents of nuclear power don't understand basic nuclear science.
Well, I mean, on some sense, obviously true, but perhaps irrelevant. How's that?
Okay. Last one for David Roberts. You are a smarmy coastal elitist who was mistakenly born in coal country of Tennessee.
That's true.
All right, let's give them a round for getting through that lightning round. talking with David Roberts and Elizabeth Colbert at Climate One. I'd like to talk about the importance of personal action. Elizabeth Colbert, a lot of people think, read your articles, okay, I get it, what can I do? So what is the significance of personal individual action? What can we do that matters?
Well, I mean, there are things you could do that would make a difference to your own carbon footprint, but I think that, you know, looking at the very significant numbers, you know, Americans are responsible for, you know, many tons of emissions per year. And when you look at what it would take to really take your emissions down to, say, the, you know, the average level of what someone in India is emitting, it would take you know, cutting off your power lines. Basically, you'd have to like really live, you know, off the grid and very, 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 very differently from the way most of us live today. So you know, the things that make a big difference are, you know, not driving and not flying and those are serious, you know, commitments for many Americans, but they would make a difference to our carbon footprint. Not heating your house, not air conditioning your house. I mean, so there's a lot of, you know, things to do, but most of us, you know, to be frank, are not willing to do them, and I include myself. So I think that, you know, when people ask me what can I do, my answer is always, you know, you can do the things, and you should do. Everyone should be trying, simply for, you know, ethical reasons, to reduce their own carbon footprint. But the things that are going to make a difference are so huge. They're obviously political, and it means getting involved in politics and, you know, really immersing yourself in that and being part of the constituency for very serious change. It's a full-time job, actually. But, you know, that's something that people can do.
And that gets us something, which is the idea that we can all sort of address this, our conscience, and solve this problem within basically maintaining our comfortable lifestyles as they are. Change your diet a little bit, change your behavior a little bit, not have to change your profession and become a radical activist rather than a New Yorker writer. Can we really address this problem staying in our comfort zones, or is this going to be so big that it's going to cause us to change careers, change our lives in a way?
We're certainly never going to voluntarily give up material comforts on a scale that matters. I'll say that categorically. The only way we're going to give up material comforts on a scale that matters is if it becomes law. That's what laws are for. That's what governments are for.
What about, some people would say, the power of a moral example? You know, what if it was like getting on an airplane is kind of like clubbing a baby seal? It's like something you just don't do, right? Or owning a slave. No one here thinks about owning a slave. Elizabeth Colbert?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think people have a long time, you know, when I was writing field notes, I interviewed a scientist in Princeton, Rob Sokolow, and he made the point to me, you know, look, this is like slavery. At a certain point, there will be, you know, things will flip and emitting carbon will come to seem, you know, bad. Now, we haven't gotten there. And it still raises the question of whether we're going to, you know, whether you're going to be able to get on a plane, you know, fueled by biofuel potentially, or whether you're simply not going to be able to get on a plane. And I can't answer that question, nor can I tell you whether that's going to happen. But it's possible. It's possible that is what we need, and it's possible that will happen, that it will simply become ethically unacceptable, you know, to emit CO2. I look forward to that day.
But let's note that slavery was not conquered in the U.S. by slavery becoming morally unacceptable. It was not solved through persuasion of slave owners to voluntarily give up their slaves.
Good point. Good point.
You're listening to a conversation about news and the climate narrative. This is Climate One. You can check out our podcast at our website, climateone.org. Greg Dalton will be back with his guests in just a moment. You're listening to Climate One. Greg Dalton is talking about covering the climate beat with veteran journalists Elizabeth Colbert from The New Yorker magazine and David Roberts, staff writer at Vox. Here's Greg.
Elizabeth Colbert, do you ever censor yourself and not talk about climate because you'll think you'll be a downer at a social gathering, or, oh, there goes, like, oh, yeah, we know. Like, do you ever, like, pull back and not go there because you just want people to like you or not? Not
I think I don't get invited to that many.
She's already got a reputation.
Yeah, exactly. It's not really a calling card. The Debbie Downer problem. I think that's actually a bigger issue about, do we talk about these things, you know? And people have written about this too, you know, do we actually even talk about climate change? Or is it something like, you know, you don't talk about, you know, death at a, you know, social gathering, even though everyone is aware that they're all going to die eventually. So I think that these are interesting questions and important questions. And maybe if we were all talking about climate change, we'd actually be doing something. But it does have that sort of like, you know, don't talk about that kind of feel to it.
David Roberts, is the Paris Climate Accord meaningful progress?
Yes. Unequivocally, yes.
Elizabeth Colbert?
Yeah, I agree. I think it is progress. Is it enough progress? You know, clearly no, but it's important. It was for the one, you know, brief shining moment that it existed, where...
still exists.
It still exists.
The U.S. has not really pulled out yet, and the first day the U.S. can pull out is after the next presidential election.
Yes, that's true, but I think it existed on a... aspirational plane. You know, this is we all agree that we need to do something, and we all agree that we need to actually ratchet up our commitment as time goes forward. And when you start pulling, I think what the Trump administration is doing that is so damaging to this framework, which was, as I say, built largely on hope, is saying, well, you don't really have to participate, and that is really, I think, potentially, we'll see. We're going to see what happens. But I think that people had to have faith in each other. It was a moment of global cooperation. And once one of the biggest players in the room says, I'm not cooperating, I think that is very damaging, I'm afraid.
I almost think, depending on what you ask me, that's wrong. I almost think that Trump crapping all over the Paris Climate Agreement is the finest endorsement the Paris Climate Agreement will ever receive, and you saw the reaction among the other participants, which is they drew together and redoubled their commitments, and you saw these expressions of commitments from cities and states all over the place. Like I think, if anything, Trump might have galvanized it. So I would be willing to predict that the U.S. will never formally withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement, and that Trump's shenanigans with regard to the Paris Climate Agreement will, in the long term, serve to strengthen it.
He certainly made it more popular than Barack Obama ever could have. David Roberts, you have two kids, 14 and 12. How do you talk to them about climate? Are they sick of it? Are they bored of it? Do you shelter them a little bit from how dark you think it is?
You know, my family, we all share a morbid sense of humor, so... But when I talk to them about it, the way I try to phrase it is, it's a big, all-encompassing problem, but the flip side of that is that you are so needed, and there are so many places where you are needed, and there are so many ways that you can be helpful. Like, you can go into engineering, you can go into politics, wherever you go, you're needed to solve this problem. So in a sense, like, it's perverse to tell kids, like, at least you're going to have moral clarity, right? At least you're not going to be like the U.S. in the 90s, where we're all peaceful and prosperous and just handle it really badly and flail around not knowing what to do. Like, you're going to know what to do, but you're going to have clarity throughout your life.
Elizabeth Colbert, you have three sons. How do you talk to them about it? How do you think it'll affect them?
I'm with David here. I definitely come from a family with a very morbid sense of humor. So. But I do have one son, actually, who's studying atmospheric science. So I guess something got through them. Yeah.
Great. We're talking with Elizabeth Colbert and David Roberts at Climate One. I'm Greg Dalton. Let's go to our audience questions. Welcome to Climate One.
Thank you. Andy Gunther. Thank both of you for your incredible contributions to our national dialogue. And particularly, I wanted to ask about one of those, which was, Dave, your piece about the brutal logic of climate change, and which was, I thought, one of the best depictions of the nature of the incredible decline in the missions that we have to undertake. And I was wondering whether in the last, that was probably 4 or 5 years ago or something like that, I was wondering whether, in the, particularly with the decline in the cost of renewable energy, whether you think that that's, if you were to rewrite that piece today, would it be a little less doomy and gloomy?
So the cost of renewables is a pretty positive story, Dave Roberts.
Yeah. I hate taking credit for stuff like that. There's a climate scientist named Kevin Anderson who is among the doomiest and gloomiest. And those posts were more or less a rephrasing of his work. I'll put it this way. The destination's very far away, right? And the fastest we can go seems inadequate. So all these discussions lately about the exact size of the carbon budget to me are a little bit silly, because the destination's so far away we can barely see it. If it's this close or that close, we still, the imperative to do as much as possible, as fast as possible, is the same today as it was 20 years ago, and it will be the same in 20 years, and nothing we learn about the science is gonna change that, I guess is what I would say.
Next question, welcome.
Hi, my name is Carter Brooks. I'm an artist and philosopher of climate art. David, I want to ask you the same question, but the rephrased version that I asked Al Gore, the context of which was noting something you wrote recently around all the doom and gloom, in fact, which was that we have these things, we're worried about people's hope, and we have all kinds of reasons why we think it's going to shut down people, et cetera, but that's based on short-term studies, but this is a long-term problem. So my question is, what are we shortchanging ourselves collectively in by this avoidance of that truth, or the constant avoidance of anything that's not hopeful?
Thank you. Long-term thinking.
Yeah, the discussion of how doomy and gloomy to be, to me, is kind of tedious. A, because different people can do different things. Like what Elizabeth does with Field Notes from Catastrophe is not, she didn't try to do everything. She just laid out the problem. Like other people can talk about solutions. Not everybody has to do everything. But I think no one knows as much about the social science of how to persuade and change and move people as they say they do. I think most discussions, particularly discussions of social science undertaken by climate scientists who read an article about it last week, are less than rigorous. So my sort of advice to people is, like, I'm fine if social scientists keep pursuing that, but to the people who want to communicate and do stuff about it, just do what feels right to you. And don't worry about dumb social science studies, right? Like, humans are humans. We need some fear. We need some hope. We need some kick in the butt. We need all sorts of things. And different people will provide different things. And just do, say what you think is meaningful and true. And don't worry about the rest.
We're talking with Elizabeth Colbert and David Roberts. Welcome to Climate One.
Hi, Amanda North, and this is really for both of you. I think a lot of your comments have been directed to about America and Americans and our strong sense of individualism. When you look outside of America, there are many other cultures that place the good of the whole society above that of the individual. And there are other governments that are more centralized in their approach. You can say whether you think that's a good thing or bad, but in a topic like climate change, you look to China and see that they are capable of making changes and have demonstrated some changes as well. So I'd just be interested in your thoughts looking outside the United States. Are there more causes for optimism? And should maybe some of those stories be told too?
Elizabeth Colbert.
Well, I think that's a really good question, a really good point. And I think that the moment that we live in, it, you know, is it, will be looked back on in a very, very interesting way if we look back. Yeah, I mean, that this is a moment where we chose to say, you know, we're one of the prevailing lines, and from the major party right now, is that government is bad. At precisely the point where you can't do this, I think we're pretty much everyone who's looked at this problem would agree, without very, very significant collective action. Is that a coincidence? I don't know. But in terms of what's going on in the rest of the world, I think you do see a lot more action in other countries where collective action is much more part of the culture, you know, and you might argue, you know, good or bad forms of collective action, but where, you know, decisions are made at a very high level and then they're carried out. And so there is more going on in a lot of other places, and maybe those stories should be told more.
Next question, welcome.
Hi, my name is Wayne Roth. I really appreciate hearing and seeing both of you talk. I've followed your work for a long time. We're going to go past 2 degrees Celsius. When are we going to begin geoengineering?
Geoengineering. Who'd like to take that?
I'm in the business of categorical predictions, because having learned in the pundit game that one is never held responsible, I like to make categorical predictions. So I will predict that we will never... Well, it depends on what you count as geoengineering. Like agriculture, stuff like that, tweaking agricultural practices so they absorb more carbon, stuff like that will do. But in terms of these grand schemes for firing up particles into space and the mirrors, the space mirrors and all that, we will never do any of that stuff.
Next question, welcome.
Nate Johnson, I'm senior writer for Grist, where Dave was before he abandoned us. My question for both of you, when I talk to people, interview people about the climate, there's people who really want to talk about innovation as solutions, and there's people who really want to talk about restraint, either personal or government restraint. And I find myself sort of fluctuating on that spectrum. And I'm curious where you guys see yourselves on that sort of degrowth to techno-optimist spectrum.
Elizabeth Colbert.
I think it's a really, really good question. And it's sort of the one of the many humongous questions that hangs over climate change. Can you just do what we've been doing, but just replace all your energy systems and quote unquote solve this problem? And I do say that with quotes, because we're not solving this problem. We're only either mitigating it or making it worse. And I do fall into the school of thought that you can't just keep doing what we're doing with whole new energy systems, but actually we have to change the way we live. Now, that being said, I don't have a mechanism, you know, to get from here to there.
That's a great question, Nate. And just to do a little self-promotion, I recently did an article about Al Gore and his daughter, Corinna, who are kind of an interesting human example of this split, because Al Gore, of course, is the biggest techno-optimist in the world. And Corinna has come down very much on the sort of, her quote was, we can't just keep doing the same stuff and solar power it. My instinct with dichotomies like this is to try to synthesize them and get around them. I don't think that's a helpful dichotomy. And what I would say is that innovation comes in response to restraint. That's what innovation grows out of. And so this idea that if we put sharp constraints on particular damaging habits or lifestyles or economic patterns, that our reaction, collective reaction, is just going to be to shrink up and stay in our caves, is silly. We'll innovate ways of being happy and prosperous, no matter what constraints are put on us. So I just feel like this fossil-intensive prosperity is not the only available kind of prosperity.
Next question.
Hi, my name is Ross Hammond. I'm the campaigns director at Stand.Earth. I'm not a lifelong environmentalist. I actually came into this work by working on tobacco, where we made opposition to reducing the toll from tobacco a political liability. How do we do the same thing on climate change with state, local, national politicians?
Well, I think you know, obviously, as you're suggesting, and you know, between the legal strategies and the political strategies, there are lots of interesting parallels here. And, you know, the question, I mean, I should really flip the question back on you. How do we do that? You know, how do we make opposition to these things? I mean, one, you know, the obvious problem, and it's not subtle, is there's, you know, tons and tons of money changing hands here. And there are a lot of parts of the country where, you know, the economy is based on digging up fossil fuels and putting, you know, the carbon into the air. So it's a really, really, there are huge political issues. I think that it's a lot harder than tobacco, I'm going to say that, because of the economic implications for every single person in this country. But it should be doable, and there are a lot of good parallels there.
Can I just say one thing about it? There are lots of disanalogies between tobacco and climate and analogies, but the one thing about tobacco is there was always an easily, readily available alternative to smoking, i.e. not smoking. We are only now at the very beginning of having easily, readily available alternatives to burning the oil that these oil executives are being put on trial soon for so that to me is a key piece of the puzzle. You're not gonna be able to make oil guys into villains unless their customers have alternatives.
And there is a moral dimension to that as well. Let's go to our next question. Welcome.
Claire Brown, economics professor, UC Berkeley. For Elizabeth, in talking about policy, I think one of the most impactful ones is helping developing countries, India, China, and so forth, to develop without fossil fuel but with clean energy. How do you get that into the discussion?
Well, that's a really, I mean, that was very much part of Paris. There's, you know, there was $100 billion supposedly, you know, green climate fund to which the Obama administration had pledged $3 billion, which many people said was, you know, just ridiculously inadequate for the U.S. But that's a huge issue. You know, we like to say, you know, don't do as we did, but do as we say. And developing countries very, very reasonably come back and say, okay, help us do that, because, you know, otherwise we're just going to do exactly what you guys did. And this nativist moment that we're in, this anti-foreign aid moment that we're in, or maybe that we're always in, is really completely at odds with that. And, you know, I don't know how we're going to... That's like just another problem added on to the many that we have.
Greg Dalton has been talking about covering catastrophe with New Yorker writer Elizabeth Colbert, author of the 2014 Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Sixth Extinction, and David Roberts, staff writer at Vox, where he covers climate stories. To hear all our Climate One conversations, subscribe to our podcast at our website, climateone.org, where you'll also find photos, video clips, and more. Please join us next time for another conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment.
Climate One is a special project of the Commonwealth Club of California. Jane Ann Chen is the producer. Kelly Pennington directs our audience engagement. Carlos Manuel is our booker and associate producer. The audio engineer is William Bloom. Annie Chelsea and Devin Strolovich are the editors. I'm Greg Dalton, the executive producer and host. The Commonwealth Club CEO is Dr. Gloria Duffy. Climate One is presented in association with KQED Public Radio.